Alan, thanks a lot for this book.
You're welcome. I had probably for 2 years, I had this kind of running shopping cart in Amazon entirely of food books. And I was like, someday I'd like to reread or own these books or whatever. And then I don't know what... I finally pulled the trigger and I bought them all this week.
Really? And wow.
The actual reason that it happened was we've talked many times about my borderline obsession with the first 11 Madison Park cookbook. And right. I've always taken it from the Edmonton Public Library. And I wanted to use it this week for something or look at it for something this week. And it's no longer in the catalog.
Oh my God, you wore it out.
I think so, yeah. And so I was like, fine, I have to buy all these books from Amazon. And so I got my 11 Madison Park cookbook. But another thing that I had in the shopping cart was, you've talked, I think on the podcast, or at least in conversations with me, about really wanting to read some of the writings of Jonathan Gold, the late Jonathan Gold, the former food writer of the LA Times, and then later the New York Times, I believe.
Right.
And so, as far as I know, the only collection of his writing is called Counterintelligence. That was the name of his column for the LA Times. And so, yeah, I got you a copy of that because it's not your birthday yet, but you'll be in Japan on your birthday, right?
Yeah, totally. Which is like placing this episode in a very specific time frame, but what I was about to say, I was going to place it in that very specific time frame as well, because I was going to say this will be amazing to bring on the plane and read. I just started reading the introduction like just before we logged on to start talking, and already I was being swept away, and I was like, oh man. It's, yeah, the subtitle is Where to Eat in the Real Las Vegas, and I think it's sort of a
Los
chronicle
Angeles.
Of, oh, sorry, yeah, thank you. I'm just going to say that again.
I knew you, no, leave it in.
Oh, fine, Alan, I'll leave it in. The subtitle is Where to Eat in the Real Los Angeles, and it's, I think, basically a chronicle of this, or part of it, I think, is a chronicle of his journey at trying to eat at every restaurant on this very specific street.
A certain street,
called,
yeah.
What's that? Do you know what
it's called? Yeah, sorry, a certain street. No, I can't remember offhand.
Yeah, the street is called Pico, I believe. Wait. Yeah, Pico Boulevard. And yeah, I just started reading the first couple of paragraphs of the foreword, and I was just like, oh my God, this is gonna be an amazing read. His idea for just like eating at every single restaurant on this street is just like this romantic notion of, you know, someone who is like obsessed with learning about the things that are around them and the food that are around them and the culture that they're living in. And I just, yeah, I've always kind of like that. I've been aware of that story of his, as like sort of like a part of his inspirational journey to becoming a food writer. And yeah, I don't know. I've always found it kind of like very compelling. Mm-hmm. So I'm excited to read it.
It's a cool, like, as opposed to what I imagine most food writers, the way that they pick where they're going to eat, it's like, oh, well, this is the hot new place. I better go to the hot new place.
Right.
And it has them going all around. To say I'm going to eat at every restaurant on this street, it's awesome because it like adds a kind of methodical element to it and a kind of discipline element to it, because there might be some places where you're not actually, you don't feel drawn to it or attracted to it in any particular way, but you still go there and it exposes you to things that you might not have usually found. But
exactly. You might make a discovery that you never would have made unless you, you know, got this notion that I'm going to try everything on this street. And like in the first couple of paragraphs of the foreword too, he started this journey. I don't know at what point, if he finishes it or not, but like he started this journey before he was even really a food writer.
Right.
Like he was just, I think he was still going to school and he had like a, a writing job that was like near this street and he lived on it. Mm-hmm. And he was like walking back and forth and he was like, I should just try all the restaurants over here. So yeah, pretty cool. I'm excited to get through it and report back.
Okay. I actually got a copy for myself too. So we'll have a book club.
Excellent. That's perfect. We can do a whole episode.
Sure.
We can pick our faves. Welcome to Food Court. I'm Shale McDonald, and I'm here with my pal, Alan Studdeby. How you doing, Alan?
Great. Thanks for asking.
We're two chefs from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food, and we love to talk about it. Alan, do we have any follow-up? I mean, follow-up number one, I still haven't eaten balut, and it's not going to happen before I go to Japan. It's just been so crazy.
Oh, yeah, it's going to be bonkers that, sorry to timestamp this recording, but going into a scorcher of a weekend, it's going to be crazy at the ice cream shops.
Yeah, and I guess that maybe I should disambiguate the timestamp a little bit. So I may have said this on the show already, so this may be redundant information, but originally we were going to try and record an episode while I was in Japan, but then it started to seem like that was going to be logistically difficult for us to record potentially, and then also for me to edit while I was there. Mm-hmm. And so we changed the plan so that we were going to pre-record a few episodes. And so we're kind of recording a few episodes right in succession, three in the last week and a half, I think, or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to roll them out over the regular episode release schedule, just so that my butt is covered for the time that I'm in Japan. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I suppose there's still a possibility that when I'm in Japan, I could figure out a way that we could record while I was over there that would be reasonable. And I would love to do that if it turned out to be possible, but I just didn't want to necessarily risk not having an episode to release. So, mm-hmm. So here we are. Before I go to Japan, but while you are listening, dear listener, I'll be honestly just about on my way home, I think. Mm-hmm. So what do we have to talk about, Alan? Or do you have any follow-up?
No follow-up for me.
No, nothing major. I mean, yeah, seeing as we just talked a couple of days ago, it's hard to have reasonable follow-up. Mm-hmm. What's our topic for today?
Our topic is what we're going to call regional shorthand, and I'll give you a little bit of a background on this. This is we're going to be talking about writing menus and designing dishes, but we're going to talk about this kind of tool that some chefs use by default, and it's where we basically, if we're working with a featured ingredient and we associate that ingredient with a regional cuisine somewhere in the world, we associate it with a regional cuisine, we just start ransacking that cuisine for other ingredients that are traditionally used with that or that we associate with it to build our dishes. So I'll give you an example, like a really specific one. How about maple syrup? This is easy because there's only really one part of the world where this is made in large quantities, and that's like the northeastern part of North America, Ontario, Quebec, Nova Scotia, New England, places like that.
I wonder if they have maple syrup in Japan. I mean, they have lots of maples there. I don't know if they're all like ornamental, but
I'm pretty sure I've seen that birch sap and maple sap are common things to mm-hmm. buy in grocery stores in Japan. But anyways, so if I knew I wanted to make a dish based around or that featured maple syrup, I have a general idea of what the traditional cuisine of the American Northeast and Eastern Canadian provinces is. And so I have this kind of association, like some of the common ingredients would be like pork and oats and rosemary and apples and squash, butternut, like pumpkins, squash. And so I can use that to build a dish. And actually I did that on the most recent menu at Ernest. We had a pork belly dish that had it was pork belly glazed with maple syrup, an oat cake, some poached apples, and then like a rosemary, granola kind of crispy component. Right. But it had this kind of origin in associating maple syrup with Eastern North America. And so it can expedite the menu writing process where you like have these clusters of ingredients that you associate with regions. And maybe your understanding of the regional cuisine isn't very nuanced, but,
right.
And we will explore that. Cause I know for me, like I've got, yeah, like say like with Mexican cuisine, I can tell you the 10 ingredients I associate with Mexican cuisine, but I do not have a very nuanced understanding of the regionality. Like I'm thinking probably more like Tex-Mex style, but so it can be a great tool for making dishes, writing menus. But I remember a time where like I was sitting in reading the menus for places like say like Jack's Grill, Hardware Grill, Red Ox Inn kind of thing. And you start reading the entrees and it's like, okay, we've got, I'm kind of just making this up, but say like, okay, braised lamb shank, with, you know, spices, apricots and couscous.
Right.
Like, well, that sounds delicious, but like, obviously it's kind of inspired by a Moroccan tagine because it's like braised meat and couscous. It's not authentic or anything, but I can see that that is the clearer inspiration of that dish. And then we go to the next entree and it's like, whatever, you know, beef short rib with gochujang and, you know, crispy green onion cake or whatever. And it's like, okay, well now we're in Korea and it's not, maybe it's not traditional Korean, but you can obviously see if they're using gochujang and stuff like that, that that's where they're headed. And so
drawing their inspiration from. Yeah.
Yeah. And then maybe the next one is duck confit and lentils. And then we're in France and that kind of thing. So the pitfall one is that it might seem cliched or not very original to people who understand, who can look through it and see the regional origin of the inspiration. And the other one is that it's hard to, especially if you're hopping around the globe like that, like from Morocco to Korea to France and everything, it's hard to have a strong brand identity or whatever on your menu when you're just kind of cherry picking whatever you want from all around the world. But anyways, what we wanted to do today actually was to kind of illustrate this, this whatever you want to call it, technique, crutch, whatever. And we're going to, Shale and I are going to present to each other an ingredient. And then the other person is going to spill their guts and admit the very narrow,
exactly.
Some of the very narrow regional associations they have with it and what the like family of ingredients that they would, if they had to write a menu in 30 seconds, the ingredients that they would ransack from that cuisine and to put something together.
Right.
How did I do, Shale?
I think you did really good. I would say that there's like maybe an extension of the idea that takes like, that is like a little more of the, that uses this crutch, let's call it, to take a dish and expand that out to a branding or a menu concept. So, you know, like, you know, you might wind up falling in love with, you might have a particular dish somewhere. Let's take your Moroccan tagine example.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you go to a Moroccan restaurant or you go to Morocco and you have a dish and you're like, oh my God, this is amazing. I have to like bring this back and expose people to it, you know, in my city or in my neighborhood or whatever. And I'm a restaurant owner or a chef and I'm gonna, you know, put this on my menu. And then you use that to like build a menu concept around. So like you start with a starting point that's a dish, but then you make an entire Moroccan menu because you're, you know, because you want to feature this one, or you want to expose people to this one aspect of it or whatever. And then, you know, so I think, I don't know, in that case, it's maybe, I mean, depending on the amount of research that you're willing to do, maybe it's not so much of a crutch. Mm-hmm. In that case, it's just, I guess like, but I just think it's similar because it gives you a groundwork on which to do your, or it gives you like a a base for which to start your creative work from, and mm-hmm. and allow that like to guide the creative decisions that you make, mm-hmm. Rather than maybe, you know, some of the other things that might be important, like do people want to eat this food
or right. something like yes. that. Yeah. And it's also like the fact that it's, I would kind of make the distinction where when it's rooted, when the flavors or the group of ingredients is rooted in a traditional cuisine, you can kind of turn part of your brain off for better or for worse. So for right. instance, like yeah. let me give me to go back to maple syrup. Like, so those are my traditional associations with it because of the place of origin. But like one of my favorite flavor pairings of all time, and I use it in cocktails and stuff a lot, is maple syrup and lime.
Right.
And like, obviously limes don't grow in Quebec or in Maine, but mm-hmm. the flavors work together. And so there's this kind of line to be drawn between traditional groupings and pairings of ingredients and then what I might call like pure flavor dynamics or whatever.
Totally. Pure regional or right. Yeah. Like pure, pure sort of like flavor connections. Yeah.
Yeah. That, exactly. that are not rooted in tradition. And this is like, I right. would argue one of the big things, even high-end restaurants that are meant to develop a regional cuisine like Noma, like they, what distinguishes them oftentimes is that they spurn traditional cliched combinations like, you know, Copenhagen, like, oh yeah, salmon, dill and creme fraiche and rye bread and cucumber. Like that, right. that's what I associate with that region, mm-hmm. but they're like coming up with new flavor combinations that are more part of pure or theoretical, not theoretical, pure flavor dynamics, I would say.
Right. Yeah. And I think also trying to like look for connections between those ingredients that people may not be aware of and mm-hmm. using that to tell a story or something instead of.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't want to rope too many things into this conversation, but I think that there's also like, I think this sort of brushes up against fusion cooking.
Right. Yep.
A little bit in terms of like fusion, I think, is like a bit of a reaction to this idea or something. Like it's like, why does it's like chefs questioning, well, why do we have to have these regional associations be separate from each other? Why can't we right. take two delicious things from different parts of the world and put them together and make them work together?
Yes.
Or whatever. And yeah, so I don't know if we'll wind up getting into that. Mm-hmm. And whether it was a or whether it is a beneficial idea or not, but I,
oh,
I think that it's sort of
like and to like actually fusion exposes a lot of like the things that we're just talking about. Fusion cuisine does a great mm-hmm. job of either reinforcing that or blowing it up. So like the greatest examples that, or sorry, some of the best examples from the last 15 years for fusion to me came from Momofuku. And
right.
so you had really simple ideas like imagine shale, a caprese salad.
But oh, I love a good caprese salad. But go on, Alan. But you've got my attention.
Instead of mozzarella, it's served with tofu. this was a dish.
What? Wait, what?
But then, like, obviously, yeah, that's fusion, and maybe you think that's hackneyed or something. But like, when you think about the role that the mozzarella is playing in the salad, why couldn't tofu? Like, tofu has a similar kind of fat content and texture that's like contrasting the juiciness of the tomatoes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm sure we'll get into that.
Yeah, fair enough.
Do you want
me to kick it off?
Sure.
I'm happy to. Just give me one second here.
So you're going to say an ingredient and then I'm just going to make really, a really awkward, connection between that ingredient and a region of the world, and I'm just going to start spewing the ingredients that I associate with. Is that kind of
yeah? That's right. Okay. And yeah. then after that, we're both going to look at at what you've come up with and decide whether it holds water.
Okay, what do you got?
We'll see whether this one's like difficult or not. I'm not sure.
Okay,
but I think this is a softball. Duck.
Duck. There are two places in the world that I associate with duck. One is France and one is China.
Right.
So for the French connection, for duck, I'm thinking about rillette and confit and seared duck breast, magret. And the ingredients that I'm pulling are the traditional French herbs, resinous things like thyme and rosemary, fine herbs maybe as well. Starches, I'm thinking lentils and potatoes, nice starchy things to cut the fattiness of the duck. Possibly sweet glazes like honey lacquers, things like that. Red wine. The Chinese connection for me is entirely barbecued duck. And so I'm thinking of five spice and hoisin and that red glaze. And then my whole, this is going to be really embarrassing, but then I just go down my...
This whole conversation is going to be really embarrassing.
Really shallow understand, like my really narrow, shallow, unnuanced, not regional understanding of Chinese cuisine. I'm putting the duck with rice, some kind of short grain rice and bok choy and scallion, oyster mushrooms, sesame, that kind of thing. So that, right. There you go.
Okay. I mean, this is tough because I think, like, obviously I have a lot of the same associations that you do. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what I think too. I'm thinking France and I'm thinking China. And yeah, I don't know. Like, I feel like in my normal everyday life, just, you know, existing as a shale, I feel like I have a pretty well-developed knowledge about food and regionality and cuisines. But it seems very stereotypical that when I think of duck, I think of France and China. Mm-hmm. And I think of a lot of similar ingredients to what you just listed. Mm-hmm. And it just, it's like troubling to me because I think that, like, you know, because anytime I've actually like visited a place or, you know, had the opportunity to talk to someone who is really familiar with the cuisine of a region or something like that, there's always more to learn. There's always, you know, a different story about a dish that you're not aware of that they, you know, only really have in this town. But in this town or in the region, it's extremely popular and everyone knows about it, but you just don't know because you're a tourist, you know, like either literally or figuratively. And so it's unfortunate because I do think that, like, I mean, I know that there must be lots of other places that use duck in lots of other ways. I don't know. Like, maybe there's like something to be said for the idea that these dishes have become renowned outside of their region.
Right.
But I don't know if that's because of dish quality or colonialism. Like, it's, I don't know. It's such a sticky, slippery slope when it comes to like food knowledge about this type of thing. Anyway, I'd put my Chinese duck with pancakes, Alan.
Spring pancakes and cucumber and scallion.
Radish maybe. I mean, should we also be like, what would we do if we had to come up with something completely original, or should we leave that for the end? Or something like that.
Especially, it's difficult. Like with proteins, especially. I feel like I know that duck tastes different than beef and lamb and chicken and everything. But like to me, there's a lot more. Like to pigeonhole a protein and say like, you know, lamb and mint,
right?
Is really silly to me because like lamb and cilantro is awesome. Lamb and thyme is awesome. Lamb and basil can be awesome. Like, they're really, really more to me. really versatile, or really versatile in terms of the flavors that they can go along with.
I agree.
Yeah,
that's kind of why I wasn't really sure whether duck was a softball or not, mm-hmm. because with it being a protein, it's like, you know, yeah, it is very, you know, fundamental, right? And can go with like so many different things, mm-hmm. but still immediately both of us think France and China. And it's just, yeah, it's really funny. Like it's like pretty amazing to me how like deep rooted that kind of like, I don't know, mm-hmm. the sort of like, what would you call it? Like the prevailing wisdom or something about where a dish comes from or something is so pervasive. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
And so can I give you one that's in a very similar vein that,
yeah,
like what about lamb? Can you tell me the regions and tell me the associated pairings?
Yeah. I feel like this is a little bit I feel like this is really a softball because we've had a couple, like while we were coming up with the topic for the mm-hmm. show, we kind of like batted lamb around as kind of the ultimate sort of example of how this crutch works. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, I would say lamb for me primarily evokes the cuisine of like the Mediterranean and Northern Africa.
Okay.
That kind of area. Mostly, yeah, mostly Northern Africa and then maybe like the Middle East, mm-hmm. maybe, mm-hmm. something like that. Yeah. And so, yeah, I'm thinking Moroccan dishes. I'm thinking couscous. I'm thinking fruit and meat together. I'm thinking maybe like pomegranate. I'm thinking yogurt. And fresh herbs like parsley and I don't know, maybe cilantro. I don't honestly know if that's like really a thing, but I think that it could be, even though I place cilantro in my like mental lexicon of regionality, in my worthless lexicon of regionality, I place cilantro in like Southeast Asia and like Central and South America or something. Like,
yeah, I think it is also very common in Moroccan cuisine, like in Sharmoula and stuff, they would have cilantro.
Yeah. So yeah, that's what I'm thinking for lamb. I'm thinking it's going to be probably, well, it depends on the cut, whether it would be like a braised dish or not, but that's sort of like the first thing that springs to mind is like, I'm working with, you know, a cut of lamb that I'm going to braise and I'm making a stew and it's going to come with like, like a really freshness forward kind of like set of sides, something like that.
I think there is probably also a good, like, I know that part of France is Mediterranean, but there's also an important French connection in lamb where I'm putting it with red wine and tomato sauce and white beans and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's true. Although I would say like, you know, when you mention those other French ingredients, I'm also thinking pork. So it's, I don't know. Yeah. It's interesting.
And actually, that's a really funny one because yes, that's exactly where my mind goes, basically to the Islamic world, like to the Middle East and North Africa.
Right.
And all the countries of the Mediterranean, but like in my own personal, genetics, surely there's an important UK connection to be made, right? Like lamb and mutton in English, Scottish, Irish cuisine, like that was one of the staple proteins, right? But that's kind of, in terms of my chef mind, that's very secondary. And I don't know if it's because those cuisines aren't as like flashy and fashionable right now, or do you know what I mean? Because then the flavor combinations become like lamb and turnip, potato, rutabaga, kale, cabbage.
Should we have an argument about what's going in your shepherd's pie, Alan?
Is there an argument to be had? Do you mean that?
I don't know. Isn't there this like hilarious chef argument about whether shepherd's pie should be called shepherd's pie if it doesn't have lamb in it or lamb or mutton in it?
Yes.
And that if it doesn't, that it should be called cottage pie, which is like the actual name for a shepherd's pie that doesn't have mutton in it.
Yeah. I didn't think that there was an argument to be had. That is like We still teach that in culinary school.
Not that it's like an argument. It's just that like it's like one of those pedantic things that chefs like to call each other out on.
Point of order: shepherds do not look over cows.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Okay. So, lamb. We're digging ourselves a really deep hole here, Alan.
What do you mean? Okay, you want me to give you something
because
more?
Because with each passing ingredient, it just like shows more how like basic our understanding of regionality is.
But it's funny that like this is not taught. Like it's not like in culinary school they say lamb is from the Middle East and the Mediterranean.
No,
but like so it's something that we've just kind of like passively come to the conclusion of independently. And so it's really interesting that we arrive at such a similar place.
Yeah, and I think like I think the really interesting discussion here that unfortunately we aren't really equipped to have is like where do those memes come from? You know, like where does the idea in the culture that like, you know, lamb is primarily a Middle Eastern food, like how does that make its way into the sort of general lexicon or into the zeitgeist of cooking? And I think, you know, like, I think it would be fair to say that like yours and my like impressions are like come out of like North American cooking culture. Mm-hmm. Like most of our ideas around that type of regionality, aside from some curious exploration that we've both done into different types of cuisines, like I think that, you know, our idea of the regionality of these types of ingredients comes from like this prevailing wisdom in North America. Mm-hmm. And where does that, you know, like where do those ideas come from? Like, have they come from the Food Network? Have they come from Escoffier? Like, there's like a really interesting like historical question as to like how these ideas kind of like bubble up and become like common knowledge or part of the cooking culture or something like that.
I know we're like being really self-deprecating and stuff, but like it's not so the lamb one is not crazy to me, because even if lamb and mutton are or were part of British tradition, like I did not grow up eating lamb. I didn't eat lamb until basically until I worked at Jack's Grill, I think. Like it was not part of my food culture growing up at all. And so my exposure to it was from two places. One, professional cooking and culinary school, where that was emulated in the French tradition. So having rack of lamb on the menu and everything. And the other one is like halal butcher shops. Like not that I was buying my protein there regularly, but like when you live in Edmonton, you walk by a halal butcher shop and there's lambs hanging in the window. Like that's, So, I mean, and then also of course, like, once you start, you take international cuisine in culinary school and, like you understand the importance of sheep and lamb, like to most like Islamic cuisines. So that one kind of makes sense to me. Some of these other ones though, I would really like to get into some vegetables maybe.
Okay. Okay. Well, the next one that I have for you is not a vegetable, but it's closer to a vegetable.
It's a mushroom?
It's a fruit.
Oh, okay. Tomatoes. Just kidding.
So the next one that I have for you is mango.
Mango. India.
Okay.
Yeah. Mango. That's so funny. I don't eat a lot of mango shell. But I immediately think of India. And the reason
Alan, you're missing out big time.
And Thai and and Southeast Asia, I guess.
Yeah.
So my association with mango is that the most commonly eaten fruit in the world is mango, apparently. No, I think there was like a Trivial Pursuit question or something that to me, everybody eats an apple every day, but then they're like, well, actually a billion people live in India and most of them eat a mango every day. My associations are entirely with Asia and I guess Hawaii.
Hawaii, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I'm sure they have amazing mangoes there, but I always think of pineapple when I think of Hawaii.
Oh, I see. Yeah. That's because you're ignorant.
Exactly.
Lots of fruits in Hawaii, Shale. No, but
all the fruits.
Mango, I think, yeah, actually, yeah, coconut and rice and chicken and pork. I don't know why pork is in there, but I feel like it's a they jive flavor-wise. Cilantro. I've probably bought two mangoes in my whole life, Shale.
Oh, my God. How do you stop yourself?
What am I missing?
Yeah, I think
mango
that's good.
Mango and coconut.
Yeah, right? That's definitely like the crutch associations. It's like tropical kind of... Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you're looking at like...
Oh, and dairy, actually. India. Like mango lassi, like yogurt and mango and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So India and Southeast Asia, I think those are the common associations. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, exactly. You wind up with other things that are commonly found in Indian and Asian or Southeast Asian cuisine, like cilantro and like, yeah, yogurt for India and yeah, other things like that. And then, proteins that are common or just, you know, like there are a lot of vegetarian culinary traditions in both of those places as well. And so you wind up with like the ideas of vegetarian dishes and things like that. Mm-hmm. Where would you say though that most of the mangoes that you avoid in the grocery store in Canada come from?
I mean, I would guess Mexico, but I...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Mexico, I think, is like, yeah, the number one place that we import mangoes from. Mm-hmm. And mangoes are a huge part of eating in Mexico. They're like often just available for consumption. I had them for breakfast just about every day that I was in Mexico for a short time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, which, you know, doesn't really pop up for me, you know, when I think about mango, like for some reason, Mexico doesn't really pop up in my culinary lexicon, mm-hmm. but all of the mangoes that I eat pretty much come from there.
Right.
So it's just this really interesting kind of paradox.
And there is a mango jarrito. So I do have a bit of a Mexican connection in my mind with it. Actually,
right.
Sorry, tangent, Shale. Mm-hmm. When we worked at the Elm catering kitchen on 118th, every, I don't know, maybe just a couple times a year or something, we would go next door to Paraiso Tropical and get frozen pupusas and curtido and stuff for lunch. Do you remember that?
Yeah, totally.
Since we worked there, they've opened a second location on Calgary Trail, not too far from my house.
Which I've been to because it's pretty close to the Kind Ice Cream Kitchen.
Yeah, totally. So I've started taking Cora to like, or on these little food adventures. Like we went to Chinatown once and like went to Hong Kong Bakery and she had bubble tea for the first time and went to Lucky 97 and got bao and stuff. Anyways, but we went to Paraiso Tropical to check out their little lunch counter there and had yuca fries and mango jarritos and stuff.
Sweet.
It was fun.
Yeah, that's awesome. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they have good food there. They have like just like fried pork belly there.
Oh, is that right? Yeah.
Yeah. And it's pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. I have to kind of steer clear of that place because of that, actually, because like I'm always tempted to get some when I'm in there. It's like crispy outside and yeah. And it's just like really well seasoned and it's delicious. But yeah, I could eat a whole bunch of it and it's really rich. Mm-hmm. Okay, Alan, I'm ready. Unless you got something else to say about mangoes.
I do have one more important thing to say about mangoes. And that's that my favorite food joke of all time was Seth Rogen on Ugly Delicious with David Chang. And
I don't know if I've seen that.
There's an episode where David Chang visits Vancouver and hangs out with Seth Rogen.
Oh, cool.
And David Chang mentions the fruit mangosteen. And I don't remember the exact how it plays out, but... Seth Rogen makes this joke about like, it just sounds like a you're introducing a Jewish fruit to someone like, this is mangosteen, this is papayowitz.
But really, mangosteen is like the best fruit in the world.
I never had it.
Oh my God. Okay.
Sorry.
I have to eat a balut and you have to eat a mangosteen. They're pretty, like readily available.
Oh, is there, right?
In Edmonton.
Yeah.
I haven't had too many like ones where, like, I had a couple. I've never been to Asia, not yet anyway. So I've never had the opportunity to like have one that's like super fresh, but I had a couple that were, from what I understand, of pretty good quality from the Granville Island market in Vancouver, and they were life altering. I don't know. Yeah, it's
really,
it's a pretty amazing fruit. It's delicious. Like it's amazing. And then I've had a few in Edmonton that were good that reminded me of the ones that I had in Vancouver, but that didn't quite hit the mark. But I think, yeah, like, yeah, I think having it for the first time, like, it would still be amazing.
Okay.
They are delicious. Just go grab one when next time you're at Lucky.
Sure.
Having a bow. Just grab a mangosteen.
Okay.
Sometimes they have them there. What else you got for me, Alan?
Corn. Yeah.
Oh, man.
What?
That's cruel. Alan, that is cruel. Okay. So on my list, I have corn, but I have two sections on my list. Section one is like foods that are kind of like easily identifiable to a region that I was going to, you know, use for the broader part of this topic. But I had a few that I thought of that I was like, oh, that's kind of hard to sort of like nail down the regionality of, like, in a shallow way.
Oh, really?
and I had corn on that list.
That's interesting to me.
I mean, yeah, I can work with that. I can work with corn. But yeah, I was going to throw corn out to you as like kind of a tough one at the end. But yeah, now I guess, yeah, unfortunately, now that I'm thinking of it, I guess, like, you know, the major association would be like Mexico and Central and South America.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, I'm not 100% sure, but I think corn is, yeah, native to North and Central America or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And obviously nixtamalized corn or maize is like used as a staple in most Mexican, Central and South American cuisines. So like things like pupusas that you mentioned, they're like, you know, they're like these kind of stuffed pancakes that are made out of corn flour, or obviously like corn tortillas and things like that, that are, you know, staple in many of those cuisines. I would say, so yeah, then I'm thinking like, you know, corn, sour cream, cilantro, pork. I'm also thinking like Tex-Mex. I'm thinking like, don't kill me, Texans, but I'm thinking chili. I'm thinking like, yeah, those are the big ones for me. I mean, obviously like corn, I think, is, you know, shockingly North American compared to most things.
Oh yeah, you know? Absolutely. Yeah.
Which is interesting. You know, like when I think of like eating corn on the cob, I don't think that happens in a lot of other places in the world.
It does not happen in Europe unless it's part of like a novelty Mexican restaurant kind of thing. It's the Austrians that we hosted when I was in culinary school were shocked to know
that you would just eat corn off the cob.
Although, and this is something I've never really integrated into my broader understanding of how corn is consumed across the world. Apparently, because like I grew up eating corn on the cob, like it was a summer, sorry, this is an Ontario summer thing, roadside stands, you buy corn on the cob in the summer, you grill it, you butter it, you eat it. Apparently, my grandfather never ate corn on the cob and insisted that it was just, it's cow fodder. Like it's just animal food. Like humans are not meant to eat it. But
I mean, I don't want to get too deep into it, but I can see some reasons why he would feel that way about it. Seems like it doesn't get digested very well.
Yeah, well, Shale, you should know insoluble and soluble fiber are essential to the human gut health.
I do know that. Yeah.
To me, even though I grew up eating it, now, since I'm such a worldly chef, my mind immediately goes to Mexico, Central America, and South. It was, I think that like for Aztec and I don't know about maybe Mayan culture too, like it played the role that wheat played in Europe and the Middle East. Like it was like the staff of life kind
staple
of stuff.
Grain.
Yeah. Yeah. And so because of that one kind of cluster of ingredients, like I'm like all the other new world vegetables, like tomatoes, bell peppers. But then like thinking further.
Tomatoes?
Yeah.
Alan, those are obviously Italian.
Oh, are we going to do tomatoes? We'll get to tomatoes. But, and the other, again, like completely outside of my, like the food I ate growing up, but the going north, the idea of the three sisters on the, like in the new world. So corn, squash, and beans, like that's an immediate mm-hmm. association for me too. And I've put it on menus all over the place. Like in the fall when every chef needs to put butternut squash on the menu, it's like butternut squash and corn and beans. And then you throw in some other new world, like cranberry or wild rice or something, and bam, you've got yourself a fall dish in North America.
You got yourself a harvest dinner.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's about as original as the harvest dinner that ChatGPT made for us. So.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, good old ChatGPT. He'll outlive us all.
But even, yeah, like to me, it's entirely new world. Oh, actually, the only other association I have in my mind that's not from New World would be dried corn, like polenta. So I go to Northern Italy and Southern France, where we've got unnixtamalized corn, which means it's deficient in B vitamins. And if you try and live on it, you get pellagra. Northern Italy. And so like there I'm getting like hard aged cheeses. I think it's used in some like baked goods and stuff in Europe sometimes for texture.
Yeah.
Basically I'm thinking about the new world with corn.
Totally.
Lime, corn and lime. Lime juice. Chill. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Crema.
Yeah. Cumin.
I was wrong about corn. In retrospect, it shouldn't have been on the hard list at all.
It's okay.
Yeah. Okay. Moving on. You want my next one? Actually,
sure.
I feel kind of bad about my next one too, because it sort of feels like it might be a little bit redundant. But my next one is cashews.
Oh, interesting. Cashews. So I love cashews.
They're amazing.
To me, I'm thinking of Asia and South China and Southeast Asia. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about meat and nut combinations, like stir fried meat, like maybe like seared in nut oil or oil that's nuts have been toasted in. And maybe in combination with fruit too. So like beef and pineapple and cashew. And then the associated like kind of stir fried veg, like bell peppers, maybe mushrooms, snap peas, that kind of thing.
Yeah,
that's funny because that is something that I would have eaten, not regularly, but eaten, like been very aware of cashews growing up. But in my mind, in terms of like linking it to a cuisine, I'm thinking of like kind of like the way that peanuts are used in Thai and Vietnamese. Like that's where I put them kind of in the world, in global
totally.
Cuisine.
I think for me too, India is a big one.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
For cashews, there are like quite a few Indian dishes that have cashews in them as well. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I associate it with things like you said, like stir fries and curries and things like that, mm-hmm. primarily. Mm-hmm. And actually, I don't know. I'm going to Google something, Alan. Clickety clackety, clickety clack. I just want to find out like who the largest exporter of cashews is. Because cashews is actually like a pretty rough industry too.
Oh, really? I'm going to guess Turkey.
Okay. Top of the list is Vietnam with 43.8% of total exported cashews.
Okay.
Then we've got Ivory Coast, Ghana.
Oh, so it really,
India.
Really has to be tropical. Yeah? Okay.
I don't know, Alan. Netherlands is on this list with 4.4% of the world's exported cashews.
Something doesn't add up, Shale.
Yeah, I don't know. This is just a Google search, obviously. I have no way to fact check this immediately, but I am seeing pretty similar information from several different sources here, though, which is interesting. Yeah. Anyway, they pretty much have to be like harvested and then cured, or like peeled. So they come in this like kind of big pod, and you have to take the pod off the outside, mm-hmm. and then they have to be like cured. And that a lot. Well, I don't know. There probably is a way to tool machinery to do it, but in most of the stuff that I've seen about how they're exported, it's like, you know, just done by hand. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the people who are harvesting cashews and like processing them get injuries from their work because they have to use like these sort of like sharp machines to like cut the outer hulls off. And like,
I see you.
Yeah. And I've seen like, yeah, a bunch of like video and pictures of factories where like, you know, 50% of the people who are working there are like missing parts of their fingers and stuff like that because they've been lost to the machinery or whatever. So yeah. But yeah, I think Southeast Asia as well, and it looks like that's, you know, a realistic origin for them, so that's interesting. At least, sorry, that was a bit of a downer, I guess.
It's okay, show.
I mean, we were using a lot of cashews at Kind Ice Cream for a long time too, and like while we were doing it, we were kind of aware of that, and it was sort of kind of in the, because when we first started, we weren't aware of that. Mm-hmm. And then when we started looking into where to purchase them from,
right,
you know, like how to procure a lot of them, mm-hmm. You know, that some of that information started to come up to the surface, and then we were like, oh, well, you know, maybe this isn't the best product to be using.
And was it, whatever, were you using it primarily like in a vegan context, like cashew milk?
Yeah, that's right. We were using part of our formulation for our dairy-free ice cream had cashew milk in it, mm-hmm. that we were making in-house. Mm-hmm. And so we were just buying bulk raw cashews to make cashew milk out of. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then, but yeah, we've subsequently switched to like an all coconut milk based.
Okay.
Dairy-free ice cream base, which, I mean, I haven't heard a bunch of stuff about the ethics of coconut harvesting.
I was going to say, well, you know how they make coconuts, don't you?
yeah, exactly. I'm not entirely aware, honestly, but I haven't really heard anything too alarming about coconut export. But yeah, please feel free to enlighten me, listener, if you know more than I do about it.
I mean, there's no way they're not burning down parts of the rainforest to plant coconut stands, I would say.
Almost certainly. I think they burned down the rainforest for in favor of cattle, mostly.
Right.
But, yeah.
Or
they're probably getting rid of coconuts in favor of cattle.
Isn't like hearts of palm and tropical crops like that, I think, are also compelling economic reasons for business owners to burn rainforest, but...
Oh, really?
We are out of our depth, 100%.
Yeah, definitely out of our depth.
I'm looking at my list and feeling like a lot of them are going to kind of take us to the same regions that we've already discussed a bit.
Okay.
Like the Mideast and Central America. I wonder...
Are you trying to figure out one for Antarctica? You should give me penguin out.
Obviously polar bears. Just kidding. That's a joke. sorry, is it it's my turn, right? Or no? Tell me about this. Salmon.
Okay. Salmon. That's interesting. I mean, for me, salmon means the west coast of Canada and the Pacific Northwest in the United States. And then like maybe just like slightly below that is Japan, although... Mm. I'm pretty sure from some of the research that I've done about Japan that salmon wasn't commonly seen in Japan until like, I don't know, 100 years ago or so, something like that.
You mean wasn't commonly seen on menus or in the water?
Wasn't commonly eaten. Right. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know about the water. I'm assuming that it wasn't commonly eaten because it wasn't available. Mm-hmm. So I think, yeah, maybe it's... primarily, but I don't know. That's interesting. yeah, I don't know enough about the fisheries to know like exactly where it comes from. And then also, I know that salmon is pretty common in like the UK. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and in Scotland specifically, I think they eat a lot of, I think salmon is on a lot of menus. Mm-hmm. And they, I think there is like in Europe, there's sort of like this, cultural food idea that like the best salmon comes from Scotland or right. something like that.
Yep. That's something even in the Jewish appetizing store culture in New York, they still sell Scottish salmon. Oh my goodness. I just, it was just way too many consonants. I was just like adding K's to
for comedic effect.
I think that's still a thing. Like even in New York and the Jewish appetizing stores, like they advertise things as Scottish salmon sometimes.
Right. Yeah. And then, definitely, Scandinavian. Mm-hmm.
See, that's the first one in my mind. I'm so interested.
Yeah. Yeah. That's fair. I guess I would put Scandinavia above the UK, but I would still not put it above like the Pacific Northwest and the West Coast of Canada. And I guess that's just like my own cultural bias or something.
But I think that in my mind, I make the distinction between cured salmon and fresh salmon. And for cured salmon,
right.
I'm in Scandinavia. And I'm in Jewish New York or like the Jewish Eastern seaboard. Then in terms of ingredients, there's a lot of overlap between those two. And it's like dairy, dill, capers, shallots, onions, pickles, gherkins, bagels.
Yes, definitely.
Rye, cucumber, caviar.
All those things for the cured part of it. Yeah.
And then fresh, yes, I'm thinking British Columbia, Pacific Northwest. And then there the flavors get a little bit a little less clear to me.
Not as obvious.
Yeah. Although I would also
put dill with it. Yeah, something creamy,
butter,
like a, you know, it's a cream sauce, butter. Yeah. What else? I would like fennel for some reason, mm-hmm. like is
fennel
in there.
All...
I think that's probably because of California or something like that. Oh, yeah. Like, I don't know. Anyway. Yeah. That's my list for salmon. Mm-hmm. That's where I would be going. Mm-hmm. So like, West Coast of Canada or Scandinavia, I guess.
So what are West Coast ingredients that we associate with it though?
I mean, all of my associations are like from, or a lot of them are like from fine dining ideas. Mm-hmm. And so, it's things like mushrooms. Or it's like
cream, wine, mushrooms, butter, herbs,
potatoes.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. And then like maybe, I don't know. I was going to say brassicas, but not really so much maybe. Mm. I don't know.
It is also, and I don't know if this is like North American, even though you said that, like they didn't commonly eat salmon in Japan until recently. Like there is a strong like Vancouver sushi scene connection to salmon in my mind. Like, even in Hawaii, like I had salmon poke, even though I don't know if salmon goes anywhere near Hawaii. It was just like, it's a fish and seafood culture.
I think it was probably brought to Hawaii and brought to Japan. Mm-hmm. If I had to guess based on what I've been seeing in my research, but yeah.
So there maybe is a broad, because I have my general, like the ingredients that I associate even with British Columbia, like there's a lot of Asian influence in it. And so, in my mind, salmon with like kelp and nori and rice and like that all makes sense to me. That's like a Vancouver combination kind of.
Totally. Yeah. But then there's also like an indigenous kind of connection to salmon on the West Coast, and like a lot, and you'll see that pop up on a lot of like fine dining menus as well. Mm-hmm. Like they'll use things like juniper and, you know, like other sort of like old growth foresty kinds of
cedar,
things. And then like also a lot of stuff that, a lot of stuff that comes from the ocean, like sea asparagus or, you know, like things that are like easily foraged. And mushrooms, I think, comes up quite a bit as well.
Kate.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's my list for salmon.
There is all, even though, okay, this is something kind of hearkening back to our conversation years ago about Canadian cuisine. There is a connection in my mind between salmon and maple syrup.
Oh, yeah.
And like, I'm thinking specifically.
Yeah, maple glazed salmon is definitely a
thing.
Crutch combination.
But it's funny because, tell me if I'm confused. Like, I think of like Granville Island Market. And yeah, you go and you get the candied salmon and it's glazed with maple syrup. But like,
right.
So those are two important Canadian ingredients, but like they don't make maple syrup in British Columbia.
No.
So you have BC salmon and maple syrup from 2,000 miles away. It's kind of funny to me. I don't know.
Which seems extremely far. But when you think about it in the context of like colonial Canada, I'm sure maple syrup, because it's like a you know, it's an easy to preserve kind of food, you know, as food was, you know, as colonization was moving from the east across Canada to the west, like those types of like preserved foods would be the ones that would, you know, make their way the most readily.
Yeah,
so
that makes sense.
You know. Yeah.
There is also.
So I don't think, I don't think that that association is because maple syrup was always available in BC. I think it's because it has been for quite a while, you know.
There's an interesting note in Harold McGee's On Food and Cooking. When he's talking about maple syrup, he mentions a time in North America where abolitionists and people who are anti-slavery would specifically boycott cane sugar, like white granulated sugar and brown sugar and stuff like that, and use maple syrup as a way to like to make sure that their money wasn't going towards the slave trade.
The slave trade.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that it, like,
that's interesting.
So it makes sense. Like if, yeah, that I'm thinking right now as maple syrup as a agricultural product that's like hyper regional or concentrated in the North American Northeast. But yeah, I think there was a time where it was, well, I mean, it still is, but yeah, like a household North American pantry staple. So yeah.
Right.
Okay.
And I think like, you know, a lot of the sugar that we use now obviously is like processed from sugarcane, and more like a lot of the stuff that we use specifically in Canada is processed from beets.
I don't know if that's a Canadian thing, but it's definitely an Albertan thing, like that Rogers and has plants in Southern Alberta that make beet sugar. Yeah.
Beet sugar. Yeah. And so I don't really know. Like I imagine that getting sugar that was more processed or getting sugar like from sugarcane in Canada, like maybe not so much in the States, but in Canada, it was probably a lot harder to get, you know, like it was probably easier in some cases to get maple syrup or maple sugar or something like that.
You mean like 100 years ago or 200 years ago?
Yeah, or 200 years ago. Although then there's also like, you know, obviously there's a ton of salmon in the Atlantic as well, right?
Yeah.
And so then did the candied salmon, like, was it like maybe more invented on the East Coast and then brought across, but our association with it is from the West Coast or something, because
just because we're in Alberta and we
I've
exactly. been to Granville Island a dozen times, but I haven't been to a farmer's market in Halifax, so I don't know.
I have no idea what the actual you know lineage of that of that food idea is, but yeah. Okay, I like I said, I did write down a couple that I think will be trickier. And so I'm going to try and stump you with a couple.
Try me.
Is that okay, Alan? Yeah.
The beauty of it is it's kind of like our Halloween conversation where it's like the right answer is the one that you feel the strongest. So we're trying.
Exactly. And the one that you feel the strongest is going to be the one that's like laden with with like weird bias and misinformation.
Yeah, probably.
Okay. Where are we going when I say to you, Alan, shrimp?
The southern United States and Southeast Asia. There you go.
Okay. Yeah.
So shrimp and grits, Bubba Gump shrimp. Like we're in the southern states. We're in the Gulf of Mexico. Easy. Okay. So in terms of, we're trying to nail down ingredients and flavors. So I'm saying shrimp and corn, tomatoes, spicy peppers, paprika, Tabasco,
chili.
Yeah. All of that, cayenne. We're in Louisiana. We're in Florida. We're in.
Okay.
Yeah. And then Southeast Asia, of course, like ubiquitous. Like it's like I'm thinking.
Yeah.
Shrimp and pork together. Thinking of prawn crackers. I'm thinking of ginger, scallion, lemongrass, peanuts.
Yeah.
Noodles. It's everywhere, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Obviously.
Although
eaten.
It is actually everywhere though.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. It's like in Scandinavian, like it's huge in Scandinavia. It's huge in most parts of North America. Like, I don't actually know about whether it's huge in like African cuisine, but I would imagine that it is. Like shrimp are just friggin' everywhere. Mm-hmm. Okay, Alan. This one seems easy now, maybe, but tell me about carrots.
Carrots, easy.
Name one place, Alan, that doesn't have carrots in their cuisine.
It's fun. You know what? Actually, I have really strong flavor connections that have been ingrained in me with carrots. It's a little bit more difficult for me to pin them to a geographical location. But as soon as you said it, I was thinking carrots, dairy, dill, like carrots and like roasted carrots and yogurt, whey braised carrots, dill, carrot and ginger.
That seems like a personal one to me.
Yeah, it might be.
Personal association.
Carrots and ginger, carrots and curry.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the big one though, like if I had to name a place, like I'm thinking of France. Because of mirepoix.
Because of mirepoix. And because it's the foundation of like every dish that you learned in school and most of the styles of cooking that are prevalent in North America. It's like a base foundation for most of that.
Yeah. Even though obviously, it's used in every European country and North America, I'm thinking of France. I'm thinking of mirepoix and I'm thinking of like Nantes carrots and carrots. What's the name? There's like a kind of glazed Vichy carrots. Like that was a ridiculous classical dish that we had to learn. Oh my goodness. That might be, sorry, as a tangent.
Mm-hmm.
Vichy carrots are literally.
You're bringing it back. You're going to reclaim Vichy carrots.
Like literally, those are just carrots that are cooked in the water from Vichy, France. But in culinary school, they made us put ginger ale in the water that we cooked the carrots because it was supposed to add some of the element of the flavor.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
That's embarrassing. Okay. The two hardest ones. Can you guess what they are?
Well, I mean, in this context, what makes it hard is that like when it's almost globally ubiquitous, then it's hard. So chicken is hard.
Yeah.
And exactly. Pork is hard. And onions are hard, but
and garlic,
yeah,
onions and garlic. Chili, that's what I was thinking. Like
chili is hard, even
like
though.
You said, like a lot of proteins are, you know, like what, like broadly used everywhere, and so like, yeah, I wouldn't necessarily apply that to proteins unless they are like sort of less widely used or something like that. Right. But yeah, like I think onions and garlic are the two. Like that are the most ubiquitous in every cuisine.
Alan,
do you remember? This is a ridiculous tangent and something that I don't know if we can end the show on, but I want to talk about it anyways. Do you remember there used to be a vignette on CBC television? It was like an animated short vignette that they would play in between shows sometimes. I think like I usually saw it if I was like watching cartoons in the morning or something.
Rider?
But there's a parable. What's that?
The Log Rider? Waltz?
No, not the Log Rider, but in a similar vein. Okay. Very, very similar to the Log Rider. there was a parable about a man who takes, I think, he's a traveler and he meets, or maybe he's an onion farmer or something. I think there's two farmers and they're neighbors, and one grows onions and one grows garlic. And the onion farmer is having trouble selling his onions, so he goes on a journey to like a kingdom that's like kind of far away to sell his onions. Mm-hmm. And he gets there and he presents them with the onions, and everyone's like, oh my God, this is the most amazing food we've ever had. It's like nothing like we've ever had before, and it's just like changed the entire way that we cook and consume food. Mm-hmm. And the king of the realm paid him equal weight in gold for all of the onions that he could bring.
Okay.
And so then he was obviously rich beyond his wildest dreams, and he went back to his farm, and his neighbor who was growing garlic was very jealous that he was so enriched. And so his neighbor got the same idea, and so he gathered up all his garlic and he went on a journey to the kingdom to introduce them to garlic, because he was so sure that, you know, when they tasted his garlic, that they were going to be like, oh, this is way better than onions. And so he brought the garlic and he presented it, and they were like, oh my God, this is amazing. This is the best thing we've ever had. This is even better than onions. You've changed our life. And so they paid him for the entire weight of garlic in onions.
No,
you don't remember that?
Definitely, I've never seen that.
That's too bad.
I'll be on YouTube in moments.
Yeah, for sure. Because I remember it vividly from when I was a kid. That and the one where the sun and the wind have a battle
to get someone's jacket off.
You also don't remember that. Yeah, to get someone's jacket off.
I feel like that's an Aesop fable. So I'm familiar with the story, but I can't picture the cartoon.
I'll bet the onions and garlic one is also an Aesop fable, or it's a popular traditional fable, I'm sure.
It's funny. To me, the onion and garlic one seems more like a story about economics than it does like an ethical fable.
Yeah. Oh, that's true. Yeah.
But I don't know. Maybe I don't understand it fully. So are you asking me if I prefer onions or garlic, or...
Thanks for listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sutterby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or in your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from our listeners. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram at Food Court Podcast. If you want to spread the word, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.